This is an ABC podcast.
This week on Conversations, we're bringing you stories of unsafe childhoods. Bernie Shakeshaft had a bit of wildness in him as a kid. As an adult, he went off to the territory, where he became a jackaroo on some vast properties. And he picked up some skills as a tracker from some of his Aboriginal co-workers. Today, Bernie works outside of Armidale in northern New South Wales, where he welcomes kids who are a bit like he was. Teenagers who are falling off the edge of the world into a life of petty crime and incarceration. When these kids arrive, they're introduced to a pack of dogs, and they let the dog pick the kid. The relationship with the dog brings out this tenderness and responsibility and confidence in teenagers who've been struggling with feelings of worthlessness. And that's just the start of it. The program that Bernie started, called Backtrack, has a simple mission, which is to keep the kids alive, to keep them out of prison, and to help them chase their hopes and dreams. This was the subject of a recent outstanding documentary, and now there's a book called Back on Track. I spoke to Bernie last year. Hello, Bernie.
Yeah, g'day.
What sort of shape are these kids in when they arrive at your place typically?
Pretty rough, really. When we first kicked off, they were 16 and 17-year-olds. We were working with kids that were often locked up, coming out of jail, tough sort of kids, you know. We're not a program for Indigenous kids, but by jingoes, it works for them, you know. I think about 80% of the kids would be Indigenous. Now the scary part is we're seeing kids at 10, 11, 12 years of age, you know. So traditionally, if they're not completely kicked out of the education system, they're right on that edge and doing those laps of long-term suspensions. Nearly all of them have used their three police cautions. Some of them may have already been in jail, you know, by the age of 12. They're toughing it out.
And what happens when they get off the bus? What do you do?
First thing is, let a big pack of dogs go. We've worked this stuff out over the years, and it's a really interesting thing to watch the personalities match up with the kid, you know. So it gives us an enormous shortcut straight in, because they all come in pretty quiet, you know. So the kid that's quiet, if you see that dog that never shuts up, barking, 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 you can bet just give it a week or two and that kid will be the kid that never stops talking and yelling and carrying on.
That's really interesting. You mean like there's an affinity between the dog and the kid? And who establishes that? Is it the kid that picks the dog or the dog that picks the kid? How does that work?
The dog will pick the kid every single time. ADHD dog, ADHD kid. Dog that doesn't shut up, kid that doesn't shut up. You know? Kid that wants to, or would you say fat, lazy? Yeah, it would. Fat, lazy dog, fat, lazy kid.
But it sounds like you think the dogs can sometimes anticipate the character of the kid without knowing what it fully might be. Like a kid who's quiet, the talkative dog picks that kid and then they become talkative eventually.
Absolutely. And occasionally you'll see it's the need. You know, one of our young fellas that's been with us, he's now a trainee with us, BJ. He was the flip side, the opposite. So he had this dog that wouldn't stop barking, and he was the quietest kid, I reckon, for 12 months. Never said a word, no eye contact, nothing. So here's an example of the dog bringing out the yap-yap in the kid, you know. So I think the dog taught the young person to, you know, use his vocal cords, and the kid certainly quietened the dog down. So everyone's a winner in that arrangement.
What is it about the dogs?
I don't know, you know. They're just something special. There's certainly that thing about not judging, you know. What a wonderful metaphor, and it's a great place to start with a kid when it comes through. Because the dog, he doesn't care how old he is, what colour his skin is, whether he's been in trouble or whether he hasn't. He just takes the kid right there on face value. That's a pretty good place to start, no judgement. And I often think maybe we should be taking a few lessons from the dogs as humans.
What do you get the kids to do with the dogs straight up?
Nothing. Whatever they want to do, you know. And that's where you see the kid that can't not run around. He'll be with the dog that can't not run around. So we just leave them and let that bond kind of go. But we use them in all aspects of our programs now. Do you know, in 13 years, we've worked with some of the most violent kids in our society. I think I've only ever seen about two punches thrown. And it's pretty extraordinary to see that stuff, you know. So if it looks like it's blowing up, first thing we do is one of the youth workers will grab a dog, put it in that kid's hand, walk around the block, go anywhere, whatever, but by the time they come back, they're chilled out. What a useful tool. I wish we could, you know, have all our youth workers do the same thing, but they just do something special.
You call it dog Valium, don't you?
Dog Valium.
I've seen the footage of on the documentary of how you teach the kids to teach the dogs how to stay. And it's you sort of put them down gently on the ground, hold your hands just above them and gently put them back down, but then take your hands away. I think that's pretty sneaky because you're getting the kids to be tender, aren't you? To be Absolutely. Responsible and tender.
Yeah, quiet and concentrate. It's a pretty interesting thing. Look, I think it starts to teach them a couple of things about energy, you know, because we've all got energy, whether you want to know it or not, you know. The dogs have it, the kids have it, the adults have it. So we're introducing them to those concepts and then how to quiet the mind, you know. As adults, we might call that meditation, but wouldn't dare say that to the boys. But it's the same thing, you know. We call it, hey, you want to chill your mind out. You want to just slow down for a second. If you asked them that, of course they wouldn't. But it's really good for them, and it's a peaceful place to start.
The kids often have these really hard outer shells, and they've had to have it, or they've built them up for whatever reason. Mm. Is the dog the way to pierce that shell, or just to make that shell crumble around them a bit?
It's absolutely the softening factor, you know. From there, look, often these kids, when people see them, go, how do you get that kid to sit still and quiet for just 2 seconds, you know? Does something. And again, because the dog's not judging, and we're not doing anything weird, we're just using a natural kind of thing, and they like it. They really like the energy off the dog.
How about the women that work at Backtrack Youth Works? So there's a lot of older, grandmotherly women there who seem to like hugging a lot. Does that help too?
Yeah, look, and the boys don't mind a hug as well. You know, I've worked in youth organisations that would sack you if you hugged a kid. Keep your hands to yourself. One of the things through the documentary that women point out to us all the time is the beautiful relationship. And, you know, we're rough and tumble boys as well. We're not, you know, having big sulks all hugging each other and, you know. But to hug a kid if it needs a hug, how can you take that out of society? It's the most ridiculous notion I've ever seen.
Your early life was in Armidale. That's where you live now. Was Armidale a slower town back then when you were little?
Oh, look, I think we always kept it speeding along as young fellas. I don't think it's changed a terrible lot. You know, the population's not much different. I mean, there's more houses and less paddocks around. You know, it's starting to encroach. We've even got traffic lights there now. That'd be the one thing. Two sets.
Two of them now.
Two of them now. And I tell you, I reckon one of them they only just put in to have traffic lights.
Right. A motorway will be there through any day now, yeah. I'm sure. Did you have a big family growing up?
Yeah. There were five kids in our family, an older sister and three younger brothers. You know, so I came from a loving family, but I did it pretty tough as a young fellow, you know.
Yeah. What stood in the way of you fitting in as a young fellow, do you think?
Look, if I reflect on it, I think going back to primary school, I was a left-hander. I was always going to be a left-hander, and we were growing up in a right-hander's world, you know.
And were you punished for being left-handed? Was it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll never forget the nuns, you know. There was one particular one, but any time you touch something with your left hand to write or to use scissors or something, bang, down came that ruler across your knuckles. I think that gave me a pretty healthy disrespect for learning in the early days, you know, and I think it mucked up my, you know, whether you call it dyslexia or something, but I always struggled with numbers. My reading wasn't too bad, but it wasn't a joyful place for me, school, or until the bell went, and you know, in the playground, I loved it, in the classroom, just was never going to be for me.
How about outside school hours? What kind of things did you get up to as a kid, Ben?
Oh, boy. If my mother's listening, you're going to get me in trouble here, Richard.
Mum, go and make a cup of tea just quietly while Benny owns up to a bit of stuff, please.
Oh, look, we ran around like lunatics, you know. We had a gully that was a favourite kind of meeting spot. That's where we all learnt to smoke and teach my brothers to smoke and all that sort of business. I look back on it now and I think, how did somebody not get killed with the stuff we were doing?
Truly, like what stuff? What were you doing?
There used to be a spot where they tipped old cars over there. Edge of the gully, and we used to have this game in teams, you know. One team would go and they'd have to get in the car down the bottom of the gully, and the others would throw boulders and rocks down until somebody got their head cracked, and then it was time to change teams. So that was one of our fine sports. I remember crawling in the stormwater drains as well. It's ludicrous how far we used to go in those things in the dark. Like, I look at it now and I think just one shower of rain, we could have all been dead. But anyway, someone was looking after us. We kind of lived right on the edge of town, and there was a lot of new houses being built. I remember one of my earliest memories of breaking an ankle was hearing the boys call out, you know, the builder's coming on a Sunday afternoon. What's the odds of that? Anyway, went straight through the roof of this thing, through the gyprock, down the chimney or something, broke my ankle. So we were forever doing that. I think my poor dad, because we played a lot of backyard cricket and stuff, you know, all the kids were around. Boy, we smashed some windows.
Yeah.
You know, look, we were kind of wild, but, you know, never doing too much damage.
So then when you were 12, your family upped and moved to Sydney.
Yep.
What was that about? What happened there?
Oh, look, I think my mum was starting to get really sick, had arthritis, you know, so she was really toughing it out. The climate, because Armidale gets pretty cold in winter, the climate was one of those factors. So we upstumped and moved to Sydney.
And how did you get on to school there? Was that easy or harder for you there?
Boy, I think Sydney was a bit like letting a feral cat out of a potato sack. it just wasn't for me, you know. Look, I'd never heard of Lebanese people or Italians or whatever. We'd grown up with Indigenous kids. But we landed in the middle of Dulwich Hill on this busy road and traffic and two buses and a train to get to school. And, I was just... I was a fish out of water. It was a tough, traumatic time.
Did you get caned quite a bit?
Oh, yeah, I was the king of getting caned. And I think I can recognise that in the kids, you know. It's how they kept us in control. Well, see, it didn't really work, though. They didn't keep us in control, but, yeah.
What did you think about your place in the world? After, you know, you're having trouble with... You're a bit dyslexic, you're having trouble with numbers, you're left-handed, and that's not welcome. Mm. You're getting the cane a fair bit, and you're a bit wild. What do you conclude about the future you're going to have when you have that kind of a childhood been?
You know, I don't ever remember sort of looking forward too much. I wish I had someone like me to teach me some of that stuff now. It was surviving in the moment, you know? Yeah, it was just a survival thing, and I wasn't going to bend, you know. I think I learnt early on that you could bash me or tackle me or cane me, but it wasn't the way to bring the best out in me, that's for certain.
How old were you when you bought your first car?
I'm always a bit hazy with the numbers, but it was before I had a licence, so...
Could you do that then? Maybe you can do that now, I don't know. Can you buy a car without a licence?
Well, now I've got a licence, I'm not sure, but had my son tried to do it, I'll bet you couldn't have. Would I have been 16 or something or other? I remember doing the right thing and asking my parents, you know, because I went halves with one of my mates. Maybe he had his L's or something, but I certainly didn't have mine. And to this day, I can't understand why they didn't let a 16-year-old who didn't have a licence buy a car. Makes perfect sense to me.
And what happened to that car?
Yeah, look, I had a long history of car accidents. That was the first one that started us off. We put that one on its lid, I think a couple of blocks from the high school we were at. And the first car to come around the corner, just as we flipped it back over onto our wheels, was this big American. He was the form master at year 12 or something, and he knew me well. He came around the corner and said, "Shake Shaft, what are those tally hoes doing in your top pocket?" So there I was, double dipping. A, car on the lid that my parents didn't know I had. Smoking, always in trouble for that one. Back to the principal's office for another caning.
So then in year 11, you were sent to India. India, what was the thinking behind that?
Look, I think that was a result of the car accident. Mm-hmm. The chaplain at school was a lovely guy, and he'd spent most of his working life working in missions in India. Father Liam Horsfall, terrific fella. And I think he was a real mentor. He ended up teaching me to drive the proper way.
Isn't that nice?
It wasn't that.
So were you sent to Mother Teresa's in Calcutta?
So what happened was every couple of years he'd take a group of old boys and a group of younger fellas that were still at school. How it kind of happened, I don't know why would I have been picked, you know, and found out years later it was the church, because mum and dad weren't particularly wealthy, so I think the church passed the hat around, which got me over there. Yeah, Calcutta, it was a turning point for me. I think it was where I decided that things weren't so bad in my own life, you know. As a kid, where you go over to a third world country and then, you know, you're working in missions with, you know, leprosy and going to Mother Teresa's hospice for the dying, it was a turning point for me.
Did you treat any kids your age?
Yeah. So after we met Mother Teresa, which was just a moment, and if you want to talk about energy, you know, that loud and noisy spot in the little room that we were sitting in. I don't think I heard a word that she said, but still to this day, it was the most powerful person I've ever heard speak. I can feel that. Prickles coming up on my neck, just remembering that.
Yeah, she was one of those people, was she, that had that kind of deep charisma?
Absolutely, just something about her, something special, this tiny little woman. So, yeah, we had the opportunity, we didn't have to do it, to work in the Hospice for the Dying, which is a whole heap of really small sort of camp stretcher beds with people that are dying. So I spent a couple of days in there, and there was this one young fella. He must have been about my age, and of course, you know, we had the language barrier. I wasn't fluent in any kind of Indian language.
And what was wrong with him?
All the skin. I remember taking the bandages off his leg. I can still smell it and see it, you know.
It was a gangrenous, was it?
Yeah. Well, there was no flesh left on his leg, you know. It was almost down to the bone, and it was just an infection. He was a street kid. The infection had got in, the maggots had eaten all the flesh off his leg. It was pretty traumatic, you know. And in that hospital, no clean bandages, so you had to go and wash them all and then bring them back. I don't even think we had gloves or any of that sort of thing. There certainly were no Panadol. And yep. I held that kid's hand while he passed away. And I think that was it. No whinging, no complaining, no sooking. Just slipped away and it was deeply, touched me deeply.
Yeah, you said it changed you a bit. It made you think that maybe things weren't so bad in your life or in your future then?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think I was hell-bent on killing myself, you know. Not like a suicidal thing, but just wild and not caring and doing
death by automobile,
things.
Death by this or that.
That's right, yeah. Death by self-destruction.
What was your first job once you got out of school, Bernie?
Yeah, so school, I was just not going to make that Year 12 thing, and I think it got to a point where I realised that I was going to end up, in the old days, the HSC was out of 500, and I reckon I was on line for about a score of 10. So after much negotiating, you know, it was decided that I could leave school if I could get a job. And I think back to the chaplain that took us to India, helped me out with it was the Catholics owned this organisation called Dove Travel, Clarence Street in Sydney there. So they got me a job as a junior travel consultant. Now, for a fellow with poor maths, things were about to turn from bad to worse.
So what was this travel agent? I've never heard of this before. Is this for what, the clergy or nuns?
Nuns and brothers and priests. These guys used to do all their bookings.
Right, it's like flight centre for the clergy, is it?
That's right. Right. I didn't even see the flying nun there.
Greg, we've got to get six nuns over to Our Lady of Fatima by tomorrow, kind of thing. And get on to Shakeshaft, was it?
Yeah. Shakeshaft booked the ticket and they ended up in Tasmania. And charged them the wrong price. I think they nearly went bankrupt.
So how did you end up going back to the bush after that experience in Catholic travel agent work?
Look, you know, I had a couple of runs at a few things. I went to Teachers College for about 6 minutes. That wasn't going to work out either. But I'd had it in my head, you know, when I left Armidale, that as soon as I could get out of this rat race, I was out of there. I don't even know how I picked the Snowy Mountains, but I ended up living out of the back of my ute. With a blue cattle dog, handful of rabbit traps, a camp oven and some flour. So I lived on rabbits and a damper, and then eventually got scooped up by these beautiful people, Paul and Annette. They owned the saddlery in Adelong. And I think they could just pick it. I was in there one afternoon, and this guy, Paul Roots, said, you know, mate, do you know anything about cars? And of course, at that age, I knew everything about everything, not just cars. Anyway, I ended up working for those guys. They brought the old drover's caravan down from the hay shed and parked it up behind the saddlery. And I lived there for about a year working with those guys and starting to really learn about life and getting some useful skills.
Was that a good life, living like that? Living as basically as that for you?
Absolutely loved it. It was just fabulous. Dogs, horses, cattle, my own car. So it was a fantastic opportunity. And those guys, still today, help out all our backtrack boys. So they've got a farm not far from Armidale, and we're forever trucking kids up there.
What was it about that life? Is it the peacefulness, simplicity, or is it... Actually, now that I think about it, I don't think that life would be simple, but it would be peaceful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, peaceful, but I think it was the animals. You know, I've just always had that deep connection with the animals, and the more dogs, the merrier life seemed to be. And he had a swag of them, don't worry.
So from there you went out to the Territory, Northern Territory, to Kerry Packer's huge property out there, Newcastle Waters Station out there. That's a massive, massive property. What does that part of the territory look like? Is that Kakadu-like, or is it more red outback?
Yeah, no, we're red outback. Spinifex, big plains, you know, you can drive for an hour and not see a tree. But I loved it. I was just, I don't know, it was a magnet for me. The territory, I loved it. It was a wild and lawless lifestyle.
Yeah.
A different place entirely, like being in a different country, the territory. And it just suited me. I just wanted to ride wild horses, and certainly got my share of that.
How did they test you out with picking horses?
Oh, look, I think my first job, because I was a bit older by that stage, I must have been like 20, which was, you know, the top end age for a jackaroo. A lot of the younger fellas, you know, 15, 16, wild kids that weren't working out at school. And I remember them putting me on this motorbike saying, run the horses in, boy, you know. And I think the horse paddock is just enormous. You know, I'd been riding this motorbike for an hour and I still hadn't seen a horse. Oh, I could spot a few tracks and some horse poo and stuff, but I'd been riding for an hour and still hadn't had the hit the back fence, you know.
Right, this is a horse paddock that's as big as Belgium.
That's it. Right. It's just enormous.
Right. How do you find horses like that? I don't know. What, do you track them? How do you do it?
Yeah, tracks for sure. You know, they'll walk along pads and bits and pieces, and you know they're kind of going to be together when you find them. I thought I was going out looking for like a handful of horses. It turned out about 500 we had to run in, you know. So it was a lot of horses. I think probably that was my first test. So from there, they put me out in the outstations with just a smaller crew, you know, maybe half a dozen guys.
Are you breaking horses in as well?
No, they had a horse breaker there, so we were just mustering, you know.
And how about riding the horses? Some are wilder than others, aren't they? You have to pick your horse pretty carefully if you're going to be out in the middle of nowhere on a horse, don't you?
Yeah, look, again, I was really lucky to come across these old-school stockmen that I'd worked with, and for the first time in my life I'd bloody listened. And the first, you know, the point they made was when they ask you, can you ride? So I can sit on a quiet pony, which is what I did while all the other young fellows were coming in, you know, born in the saddle and can I ride anything? And I can't be, you know.
And what do they get? What was this today?
Oh, boy. It's a buck fest out there, I tell you. There's guys hitting the deck everywhere. Every second day someone's being flown out in a helicopter or with the flying doctor.
Right, so that's your first lesson out there is don't, I don't know if the word's still used anymore, but don't skite.
Don't skite. Be right. Humble.
Don't big note yourself.
That's it.
You were sent, as you said, further out to an outstation called Humbert River.
Yep.
That's just like, that's literally the middle of nowhere, I suppose, isn't it?
Starts to get up towards Western Australia.
Right, near the WA border.
Up there, Victoria River.
And what's your day like there? How does your day start when you're working on a property like that?
It starts well before the sun comes up. You have to pick your horse, whichever horse you're going to use. So you'll get a plant horse as yourself. You might have a dozen or 15 horses in your plant, and then you've got to decide which one you're going to ride for the day. So, you know, you'll have a string of old horses. You'll have some green, broke, young horses. And each day you need to pick very carefully which horse you're going to ride because you have to jump them onto trucks and stuff to get them back. If you can't get your horse onto the truck, then you're riding home. And at the end of 12 hours in the saddle, you don't want another two. So, yeah, we're out there, and, you know, these guys, again, back to the Pauls and Jimmy Matthews, they were just brilliant with me. Be up an hour before everybody else, boy, get your saddle on the horse and lunge him, let him do his bucking in the yard, you know. Put your saddle on and on a rope, run him round and round, let him buck before you get on him, rather than crawl out of your swag, half get your saddle on, be out in a paddock, you know. I think Newcastle Waters was 10,000 square kilometres, so they're big places. You've got to you've got to kind of look after yourself, you know.
And then once you're on your horse, do you then have to find the cattle? Is that hard too?
Yeah, that's really difficult. They use choppers a lot, so we'd start off at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and you'd just gather up as many cattle as you can. About lunchtime, the chopper will start coming in over the top and pushing big mobs together. So, you know, you're talking about mustering 1,000 cattle at a time and having to walk them 20 kilometres to the yards and then the drafting and...
And at the end of the day, is everyone too tired, or is there a fair bit of drinking and fighting that goes on at the end of the day?
Usually dry camps out there, and for good reason. Well, mostly dry. There was often the old bottle of rum was in the bottom of somebody's swag, but look, you're pretty busted after all day. You know, you're starting at 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's usually dark by the time you're done, by the time you have a feed, you know, a bit of a shower, you're off to bed.
Off to beddy boys, right. How about the Aboriginal guys on the crew? How did you get on with them?
Oh, look, straight away I just went, man, you know, Look, this is pretty racist sort of stuff out there in those days, you know. And I remember one of the first days and meeting these three guys up there near Humbert River, and all the white fellas were all staying together, about, you know, half a dozen of us trying to stay in eyeshot of each other because we don't know where the hell we are, you know. You're in a smashing big paddock and the instruction is wait until the chopper comes at lunchtime. Like, we don't even know what direction we're going, you know. But I can remember this chatter about, look at these black fellas, you know, that one's going over there, they'll be off for a bit of a camp under the tree somewhere, you know. But I was always just watching these fellas, they'd peel out three different directions and they were always riding the roughest horses with the roughest gear. Well, by the time the chopper found us at lunchtime, we'd have like 20 or 30 head of cattle between a dozen of us. And here comes old Johnny over this ridge, and he's got like 500 or 600, and he comes Max the other direction, and he's got, you know, so by the time we've got 1,000 head of cattle together, we've contributed about 15 or 20 of them, and those boys have got the rest, you know. I started wondering, how is it that these guys are so good at this stuff, you know? A, they know where they're going, I guess that helps, but extraordinary stockmen, you know, they see the whole picture, they'll tell you how old a track is, they know where the water points are, they're just... incredible stockman. They didn't really need us out there.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So we were talking before about you working up in the territory on the huge Newcastle Borders properties. There's huge properties out there in the outback, working alongside several Aboriginal stockmen who were with you there at the time. Were you asking them why, how they were doing what they were doing, how they were able to bring in so much more heads of cattle with so fewer men?
Look, you could just see it. It's like they're built in the bush. They're almost invisible. They just blend in, they're always laughing. You know, it didn't matter how hot or hard or how many times you got smashed off a horse, they were always laughing. So I liked that stuff, you know. I think the racism and stuff was the stuff that really cut me, you know. Like, I know that they weren't getting paid like what we were getting paid, and I can tell you that wasn't bloody much.
Well, where does that come from if they can do the job better than anyone? I mean, didn't that get them respect?
Like, what are we doing, you know? Is all I can think, you know, and there's plenty of examples still today. I just go, I'm not sure what it is. It's a funny thing, that racism, you know, but even the pub there at Tennant Creek or Elliot, wherever we were, Elliot, you know, still divided. Aboriginal guys on one side, white fellas on the other. So you can be out bush with these blokes for a month and you can't even go and have a beer with them, you know, they're on the other side of the pub. That stuff just still makes no sense to me. Even in the stock camp, they had to go and eat on their own in different spots, you know. There was some stupid thing about them not even being allowed in the front of the truck, you know. They had to get in the back like dogs and cattle, you know. Why do we do that when, you know, when they're the best stockmen that you're ever likely to come across?
Everything about that culture is reading the land like a book. How would they find their way to a water bore, for example?
Look, tracks, I remember we were lost as buggery one night. We had cows and calves, and that's a long day in the saddle with cows and calves, because if the calves drop off, the cows are forever turning back. It's really hard yards. So there's one motorbike on that day just to keep doing the laps, you know. And the sun was going down. So through the day... they'll fly a plane from the station, they'll come across the mob of cattle, and they'll just go and fly the plane towards the bore. And it was a new bore, so even the head stockman out there didn't know where it was. New bore, new set of yards. Anyway, the sun's going down, we're starting to go, once it gets dark, we're going to be in strife. You know, those cattle will turn back, beat us, and we'll be back to the drawing board the next day. And nobody thinks to ask these Aboriginal guys, you know. So they're riding around and around and around and around and around on the motorbike looking for this boar, can't find it. They had to fly the plane out just at last light while they were waiting, because we couldn't even see the plane. It's starting to get dark now. I trot over to these fellas who are over on their own, you know. Nobody thinks to ask them, and they're certainly not going to tell you. I said, boys, do you know where this bloody boar is, you know? Oh, yeah, he's just over this way a little bit, you know. How do they know? They've been watching the kangaroo tracks. See, that's him going in the afternoon. This is where he comes back out in the evening, you know. You fellas have not been watching where the budgerigar went. So they know exactly where it is. They're living in that land, and there's nothing they don't know about it, you know.
It can get pretty diabolical if you have an injury that far out from anywhere. Tell me how you got thrown off a horse one day.
Yeah, look, I was wheeling this beast that had gone out from the mob, and I was after him flat out. Like, that's the fun part. That's yippee-yi-yay. So I was chasing him, and I was on an old horse, you know. So when you're on an old horse, it's a wonderful day because he's not going to bark, and, you know. And I was just right on the shoulder of this beast. We're going flat out, and there was still a wire from an old fence in the long grass. The first I kind of knew about that wire was as the beast hit the deck and the horse hit the deck with me on him, and we got tangled up in a pretty bad kind of a accident, really. I knew I was in trouble straight away, and I had to put the horse down, and I was in serious trouble with my leg. It felt like a cork tie, you know. So I was back and putting danker rub into it, and as the days went on, my leg was just getting worse and worse to the point I couldn't walk.
Was it swelling up a bit?
It was swollen, you know. I had to cut a hole in the jeans to get jeans on. It was stiff as a board. So it was a fortnight before we got back to the main station, and they went, need to get you back.
Fortnight?
A fortnight with this leg. And I couldn't walk, you know. It was stiff and rigid. I couldn't ride a horse anymore. They just had me driving the truck and stuff, but I couldn't even move the accelerator, you know. I had to slide backwards and forwards or use a stick to accelerate in this truck.
So what happened when you got back to the station? Could you get to a hospital from there?
Yeah, so I got back to Newcastle Waters. Closest hospital's Tennant Creek, which is pretty close to bang smack in the middle of the country. That was about 500 k's from Newcastle. So they tip you out at the out at the mailbox, which is on the highway. I forget just the distance, but it's a good drive, you know, 50 or 60 kilometres or something out to the road.
That's just to get to the mailbox.
Get to the mailbox.
Right. Okay.
So you wait there for the 2 o'clock bus to come through.
2 a.m. or 2 p.m.?
2 a.m.
So you're standing there on an isolated country highway at 2 a.m. at the mailbox with a busted up leg that's been swollen up for 2 weeks to try and, what, to wait just to get the bus?
Just to get the bus to the hospital.
And what happened when you got to the hospital?
Yeah, so I got to Tennant Creek, saw this doctor. Like, I was having a fair bit of fun there because out in the middle of that place, there's nurses everywhere and not many customers. So was there and getting on pretty well. But saw this doctor and he said, mate, look, there's nothing wrong with you. Go back to work. So that night, got back on the bus from Tennant Creek.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. You're kidding.
Here we go. And I'm starting to get pretty jittery now because I know I'm in trouble with this leg. So 500 k's, back up to the mailbox, jump off, and one of the nurses that I'd met that ended up being my wife down the track must have made some kind of complaint at the hospital to go, that's not right, that kid's in trouble. So there was a note on the mailbox to say, wait for the next bus, we've got you booked on the next bus coming through, so wait for the 2 o'clock in the morning bus to come rattling down the highway again. Onto the bus, another five, so this is 1,500 k's, with his busted leg, back down to Tennant Creek, and the specialist was up from Alice Springs, saw me. They had me on a plane that afternoon and operated late in the afternoon down in Alice Springs. So I think they took a pint and a half of dead blood out of my leg. Really lucky not to lose my leg because the blood had started to calcify, is my understanding, and but I knew I was in trouble, you know. So I'd snapped my cruciate ligament. Didn't know what had gone on, or what a cruciate ligament is, but certainly know now, so, yeah.
How's your leg now?
I have my days, but there's plenty of other things to complain about, you know. I've still got two legs and I can get around.
So you and this nurse got married.
Yeah.
You got a kid and then came back to the territory after a while. Yep. Again, working with older Aboriginal men who you say are fast in the bush but slow in the town. Tell me what you mean by that.
Oh, man, these old guys. So this is in Tennant Creek. We're both working for Inyaningi, the Aboriginal Medical Service. So there's these two old guys. It's hard to put an age on those fellows, you know, but they say that they'd been running in that country with no clothes on, you know. So right on the edge. So I likened them to about my grandfather's age when I was a young fella. They must have been in their 90s or something like that. So you see them shuffling around in town. It'd take them about 10 minutes to walk the length of this studio, which is, what, 5 metres, you know. And there was sorry business, and the guy that used to take them out bush all the time, a fella my age, came and saw me one day and said, you got to take these old men out tomorrow, you know. And he said, you better bring them running shoes. And I said, bring me running shoes? What for, mate? He said, keep up with those old men. And I was laughing at him, you know. So out I went the next morning. My job was to take the chainsaw and cut the branches off the mulga trees that they wanted for making boomerangs and clapping sticks and stuff, you know. By the time I turned around with the chainsaw, these old men, they're gone. Whoosh, out of the mulga. Just disappeared. So I'm standing there cooing out like an idiot. Eventually one of them came back, you know, and I'd never seen the man move so fast. It was like lightning. So he came back and you could see, because they didn't really speak English, but he was really cranky with me going, what are you doing standing here? And I went, like, your mob just disappeared on us, you know? And he was really cranky going, we left you a roadmap right here, you know? They'd been walking in the soft sand. Couldn't believe that this kid couldn't follow the tracks of two men when they left them so obviously, you know?
Tell me about the dingoes that would show up when you arrived at any place with these guys.
Everywhere we went the first day, there are these dogs that appear, and I'm all jittery and thinking, gee, are we going to get attacked here or whatever? Second day, we're completely the opposite direction and 20 k's further out of town. A pack of dingoes show up again, and I'm thinking, same number, same dingoes. So then I start paying close attention, absolutely. That's that dog, that's that dog. And these dingoes are hanging around with these old men, just lying in the shade like our farm dogs do when you're out fencing. So this has gone on for like a fortnight, and every single day, these bloody dogs show up exactly where these guys are, and I'm thinking, how does this work, you know? And I'm trying to ask these guys and watching the tracks and watching what they do, touching tracks and doing these things, and just couldn't piece it together. I could see that they weren't sending them an SMS text message or something saying, be here at this time. But they were there. If they weren't there when we got there, within 10 minutes, those dogs would be there. They'd just start trickling in.
They could be there ahead of time?
Ahead of time, out in front. So when Brody gets back, I go, man, you got to tell me what's going on here because I'm going crazy. How do these dogs know where those old men are going to be tomorrow? And he said, boy, it's simple, yeah. You backtrack. You've got to track them back, boy. So what they do is they look at the tracks, and when you see it, they're the most sensational bushmen, you know. They can track a goanna across rocks, but they touch the tracks, and they know what the dogs are doing just on what the tracks are. So it's kind of, in a white fella way, as simply as I can put it, they spend about 10% of the time looking at what that dog was doing yesterday, just on his tracks. They don't have to see the dog. Then they spend about 10% of the time looking at what the dog's doing now. 80% of the energy and the visioning and whatever you want to call it, which is starting to get in a bit funny country, but putting it out in front, 80% is where they want that dog tomorrow. And about 5-6 years ago, I sat bolt upright in bed and I went, oh, those old men, they weren't teaching me how to catch wild dogs. They were teaching me how to catch wild kids. And when I looked at what we've done in our business, I went, that's exactly what we do. Most youth services or counsellors or what, they spend all this time in the background, you know, with these things that they can't change or fix. And I went, this is exactly what we're doing with the kids. So when a kid comes to our program, we just have a quick look. Where you're from, what have you been, you've been in jail, whatever. We can't change any of that stuff, whether he's been sexually abused or hasn't lived at home. We can't change that. So we have a quick look there, about 10%. Then we have a look at what's going on right now in the present moment. You know, kicked out of school, about to go to jail. It's easy to get bogged down in that stuff and you never move on from it. But what we do is we see it out in front, hopes and dreams. 80% of our energy is where we want that young person down the track.
And is that spoken or unspoken?
It's a bit of both. Pretty hard to start talking to a wild young kid about hopes and dreams, but...
But then everything about your attitude would give off signals about what you think that might be for them.
Everything's designed to be 80% out in front. So if you were to drop into the shed at Backtrack and ask some kid what it looks like down the track for him, out in front, and most of them will come up with generic things. If you went to a high school and you said to the kids, what's it look like down the front? People keep asking, you know, teenagers, well, what do you want to be doing? Where are you going to go? Are you going to university? What job are you going to have? Where are you going to live? What we do with these young fellas is go, let's make that bigger and broader. You could ask any of those kids and you'll get answers like, I want to have people in my life that trust me and that I trust. I want to have enough money to do whatever I want to do. I want to live where I want to live. I want to do something meaningful. So we don't call it work or a job. And the beauty and the cleverness of that is there's no failure in that. If you go, I want to be a mechanic, and you don't end up being a mechanic, you end up being a nurse, there's kind of already a fail with that, you know. I didn't get to where I wanted to be. With it big and open and generic, it works. That's why we have something like 87% of our kids end up in full-time jobs or back in full-time education and training. The kids we're working with are the 5% of kids that they say don't bother about. Lock them up, don't even waste any time on it. That's our start-up team and our results, and you've seen a few of those boys' examples in the documentary. Boy, look at the beauty in those kids when we just change the way we think, when we take the ability to not fail out for the first time in their lives. It just works, and it's back to those old Warren Munger men.
There's a stunning moment in the documentary where you've got these boys who are considered incorrigible by schools, and I think one of your teachers says that this is the 5% who are unteachable, and you've got them all sitting around a table, all doing an exercise together, writing hard and enthusiastically.
Yep.
What's at work there?
I think it's that 80% out in front and that you can't fail. We don't tell kids what to do. Everyone's told these kids what to do and it hasn't worked, from school to the police to the security guards in the shopping centre. We don't tell them. We do it by asking questions. What is it that you want? Nobody can make anyone come to backtrack. Not a magistrate, not the police, not the parents. The kids choose to be there. They know it's important to be able to read and write, yeah? Everyone wants to know how much change they get from buying a packet of chips in the shop or how much you get paid. So it's just a different way of going about teaching them.
So one of your senior people, when I say senior, meaning in the documentary, he seems to be in his late teens, there's a guy called Zach. He's the most lovely man, beautiful young man. What can you tell me about his story?
One of the things that we completely do differently, and it's why we don't fit into the government funding kind of boxes, is because we don't have timed programs. A, nobody can make you go there, and B, it takes as long as it takes. So we were starting a program down in Tamworth. This young fella had grown up in Alice Springs. He was sent down. He was in trouble in Alice Springs to live with his brother, who he hadn't kind of met before, in Gunnedah. And when we started this program, we were working with the kids from Gunnedah and from Tamworth that were about to get kicked out of school. They probably had below 10% attendance and were always in trouble, you know, fighting, drugs, the whole business. So he came out there to that Tamworth program. That's where we first met him. And he's been following us around ever since. So, boy, I don't even know how old he would have been, maybe 13 or 14 when we first met him. But straight away, you can just tell this kid is a natural leader. Why the hell, when you first meet him, even when he's a wild ratbag, all the other kids are following him, there's your natural leader. Why don't we just take some of that natural leadership and do something positive with it?
You show him struggling to get a job. He goes for a job interview at a bank, and it's kind of obvious that's not going to be for him. He'd finally be bored out of his mind because he's finding the work he does with you so rewarding.
Yep.
He's a natural leader, a natural mentor.
Yep.
He's incredibly tender and kind.
Mm-hmm.
Despite there's clearly a really hard childhood that's been had there.
Yep.
It made me kind of wonder, is something wrong with the modern economy? I mean, we have corporate lawyers coming out of our ears, and then you have a guy like him, and you've got to try and find, it's so hard to find space to allow him to do what he does, which is of such huge social benefit, huge social benefit. And ultimately, of course, guys like him save the economy millions of dollars. I mean, that's not what you're really counting, but ultimately, there's so much benefit to what he does. What do you think about all that?
I just think, how stupid are we as humans? Truly, we know that to incarcerate a kid, one kid in juvenile detention costs something like $260,000 a year. Costs us about $25,000 a year to look after these kids, to house them, to clothe them, to educate them, to get them into jobs. When you look at Zach, he's never going to go on welfare payments. If it's just on the economics, why is it that we can't turn this stuff and have a look at it? I get frustrated with the system. I guess that's where Backtrack kind of started, was I was getting so frustrated. I just kind of went one day, you know, you can either stop whinging about this or you can just get on and do something, which is what we did. We just got on and started doing it. We've got a saying down there is, look for the gold. It's easy to see the garbage in these kids' lives. It's easy to see that acting out and the violence and the drugs and the lawlessness. But when we look at the gold, you know, look for the gold in those kids is what we do. And you start fostering that. Sure, it takes time, you know, and we've got processes where we try and soften them and we get them to look after each other, just like humans should.
Yeah, you're able to bring out a real tenderness in these guys. And they wear the tenderness. They let themselves wear their tenderness on their faces once more, which they once did when they were little. And that's beautiful. Of course, that makes them open to be trusted by other people once you can see that on their faces. The ongoing effect of that is lovely. Does it work when you're not there? I mean, you're obviously really unusually talented at this sort of thing, Bernie, and you know exactly where these kids are coming from.
Yep.
Does it work when you're not there in these other places?
Look, the way the business is now, I'm hardly ever there. If it didn't work when I was there, I wouldn't be wasting my time starting it in other towns and keeping it moving, you know. We've got nearly 40 staff or something now. I'm rarely there, and still the results are the same. That's not because Bernie Shakeshaft's there. That's because of the systems and the way we go about looking for the gold in the kid, that we take time, long-term programs, that we address whatever the issue is that we address. If you look at the way funding is structured in Australia for at-risk youth, it's ludicrous. Like, I can't believe that we can't sit down and have a sensible conversation about this stuff, you know. If we were just funded to get kids into employment, which is the way the system's set up, yeah, employment agencies, that's all they get to concentrate on. But if that kid, Maslow pointed it out a long time ago, if you don't have somewhere safe to sleep, then don't worry about getting a job. If a kid can't read and write, how limiting is that for getting a job? So you need to be able to teach them how to read and write. It's what we do. We have a holistic program. If we need to help a kid with legal support, you know, don't worry about education if you're about to get locked up, because that's where your whole focus is. It's the same as raring a kid. Can you imagine if all you did was worry about getting your kid a job, or all you did was worry about him reading and writing? You didn't worry about whether he was eating the right food. You didn't worry about, was he socialised? Does he have friends? It doesn't make any sense. You have to tackle these things in a holistic nature. My Churchill scholarship in 2014, I saw some of the most extraordinary partnerships with government in places like Canada and Italy, and they all have the same message, you know, multiple funding sources. You know, there's organisations over there get their funding from 18 different government departments, and I doubt there's anybody that won't have seen change of government, change of program, that one gets kicked out and you have to start again. It's no good, you know. So they do things like stretch the funding outside an election cycle, so between 5 and 7 years, as opposed to 2 or 3 years. Other programs I saw only take 50% of the funding. They will not take any more than 50% of government funding, and they get the other section from philanthropy. We're a long way behind when you look at the programs that are really punching above their weight and the way they go about it. We've got one here and right here in Armidale.
In Iceland, about 20 years ago, the government recognised they had a real problem with young people, with substance abuse, alcohol, and they looked at the best research which came out of the United States. Mm-hmm. Nothing had been done with that research in the United States, but nonetheless it had been done, which showed that the two things animating this behaviour were two factors. It was boredom and anxiety. Mm-hmm. They seem to be contradictory, but it's like lifetime warfare. Mm-hmm. You know, one goes to the other.
Yeah.
So they recommended a huge program of after-school sport and after-school music. 20 years later, Iceland, Reykjavik's one of the great music centres of the world, and Iceland beat England in the European Cup, and their coach was a dentist. So there's something there. Boredom and anxiety. Is that ringing a few bells with you?
Absolutely. I was always too busy to be bored, but look, anxiety, we see that, you know, this whole mental health business with young people in this day and age. There's two things kids present with mostly. One is either depression, or the other is anxiety. If you're living in the world behind about trying to change what's already happened in the past and you can't kind of do it, you know, or if you're too far out in front worrying about the minor details, you know, like, oh, I need to be a dentist or I must get that mark in the exam, that's what brings anxiety, and back behind you, depression. Definitely boredom. How have we got the juvenile crime rates in Armidale down so low? We're the only LGA in New South Wales with long-term trends of significant juvenile crime downward trends.
Yeah,
well, boredom is the one you talk about.
I mean, I think these programs are worthwhile just in terms of on their own for the way they're able to redeem kids.
Yep.
But what kind of results has this program achieved in the broader community in Armidale?
So we had four universities spend 3 or 4 years looking at what we were doing, you know. The first year, it took them a whole year just to try and define what the hell it was we were doing. Drove them absolutely mad once they got to that. And there's a paper about to be published in the next couple of weeks that's going to look at the economic benefits of having these types of programs rather than just how much does it cost to keep a kid in jail. But the first one that they looked at, we were working in Tamworth at the same time, was juvenile crime stats, because they know what crimes kids get locked up for. And they're very easy to get the national kind of figures. So I think there's only two local governments areas in New South Wales with downward trends. Tweed Heads is down, but it's only a small percentage. I'm hesitant to say what the actual final number is, but we're talking about between 50 and 60% juvenile crime rates down.
50 to 60%?
It's a significant, mind-blowing number. It's pretty simple. You don't have to be Einstein to work this stuff out. When a kid's in and out of court, you know, and when are they getting in trouble? Friday and Saturday nights. Always drugs and alcohol involved, and on Friday and Saturday nights. What we do is take the kids with the dogs and compete in working dog high jump events or wherever we can, dock dogs, dog trialling. We take them out of town, guess when? Friday and Saturday nights. What happens to juvenile crime? Just about disappears. I remember speaking to a magistrate that was there a few years ago that went, children's court in Armidale used to take something like 2.5 full days. It's now down to something like half a day for children's court.
So you're the cause of rising unemployment in the judicial circuit in northern New South Wales.
Good. That is a feather I'm happy to have in my cap. You know, look, there's lots of factors, but I do know if you, you know, I think the stats are something like 20% of people will do 80% of the crime, you know, so it's a small number. You take that 20% of kids out of the equation and do something constructive with them. You know, in 13 years of travelling around the countryside and taking these kids to the governor's place and parliament houses and shows where all the trouble goes on in every rural country town, we've never even been chipped by a security guard.
What an amazing story. Bernie, I really wish you all the best with your program, and thank you so much for being a guest today.
Terrific. Lovely to be here.
I spoke with Bernie Shagshaft last year. Bernie and the Backtrack team are now supporting communities in Lake Cargalligo, in Broken Hill, Dubbo and Grafton, forging new beginnings for over 1,000 young people. And there's a new book called Back on Track that's written by James Knight in collaboration with Bernie. It tells Bernie's story and the stories of those whose lives have been helped by the Backtrack program. You can find out more details at our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.